I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. It's been about a month since federal agents stepped in to help Baltimore police make arrests related to the surge in violence across the city. How is that partnership working out? And do investigators have a clearer picture of what's been driving the violence since April? Rod Rosenstein, the U.S. Attorney for Maryland, joins us in the hour ahead to talk about that and the ongoing efforts against gangs in Baltimore. We'll also hear about another pressing topic, human trafficking in the state. Children and adults who are said to be forced into prostitution have been found to be working out of hotels at BWI and in Hunt Valley. A state task force is working to help them break out of that life. We'll hear about it on Midday after the news from NPR. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Nice to be with you, and thanks for making Midday part of your day again. It's a two-hour show, as usual. In the second hour today, Midday on Tech with Sean Gallagher, who's the Baltimore-based IT editor for the Ars Technica website. Several things to talk about in the second hour when Sean gets here. Telecom giant AT&T's role as the National Security Agency's number one informant. All that information about AT&T and the NSA came out of a New York Times story within the last 10 days. We thought we'd talk about that. Using a drone to smuggle drugs, tobacco, and pornography into a Maryland prison. Sean knows quite a bit about drones. We'll talk to him about that in the second hour of the show. And how does this sound to you? Europe to Australia in 90 minutes. Is such a thing possible? Midday on Tech in the second hour of our show today with Sean Gallagher, coming up after the news at 1. In this hour of the show, the subject is human trafficking. Human trafficking has been called modern-day slavery, and it's defined as the exploitation of children and adults, most often for sex or forced labor. The problem is not a new one to our state. With Interstate 95, experts have said that Maryland is a, quote, gold mine for human traffickers who often frequent hotels and truck stops off the interstate. The Maryland Human Trafficking Task Force has been working to protect victims and provide them with counseling, as well as to identify and prosecute violators. Later in this hour, we'll discuss human trafficking with Amelia Rubenstein, a social worker who has aided victims of trafficking in Maryland for years. And also, Maryland State Police Corporal Chris Hyde will be here. Corporal Hyde works with the MSP's Child Recovery Unit, where half of his workload is in human trafficking. So that's coming up a little bit later on. First, we welcome Rod Rosenstein to Studio A, the U.S. Attorney for Maryland. He's been U.S. Attorney in Maryland since 2005. Rod Rosenstein, nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
We're going to talk with you about human trafficking, too, because we know, of course, this falls under the federal statutes, violations of federal law. But before we get to that, I thought we'd take a few minutes to talk with you a little bit about Baltimore and what's been going on here since the spring, which we describe as a surge in violence. We've seen, obviously, an increase in the number of homicides and shootings in Baltimore since April, I guess. And we wonder what's going on. It's been a couple of weeks, actually more than a month or so, I guess, since some federal agents joined with the police to try to solve some of these cases, make more arrests, improve the clearance rate on homicides in Baltimore. So how is that going? I know there's been an ongoing federal partnership with the city police for a long time, but it seems even more so, even more urgent the last 3 months or so.
That's right. I think it's going well. What's changed in the last month or two are, number one, we brought in additional federal agents, which is of significant help to us. They've been able to staff the homicide unit, and they've added additional agents to work with the war room. And number two, the war room concept, the idea of gathering all the relevant intelligence in one room, getting all the agencies in one place and to talk through the issues. Because one of the challenges the city faces is just the volume of additional shootings and murders. It makes it very difficult to keep track and to make sure that you know, for example, that a non-fatal shooting in one area is related to a homicide in another area. So being able to put that intelligence together and develop charges to get those armed criminals off the streets is what we're after.
So it's different in the sense that, well, the war room concept is there, But in the past, there would be a federal task force or a joint task force. This is just actually working with the local police to help them make an arrest in a homicide.
That's right. Yeah, that's a novel concept for us in Baltimore, to actually have federal agents embedded with the homicide unit going out responding on calls to homicides.
Do we have any insight as to why this surge? I know it's not just Baltimore. It's happened in other cities here. But because I think it came on the heels of the civil unrest in April, early May, the riot of April 27th, the death of Freddie Gray, people are wondering, what's going on? Is this the Baltimore City Police taking a knee, so to speak, as an expression I've used? I've heard others use it. We're not seeing as aggressive law enforcement locally. Are new drugs out on the street as a result of the looting from the riot? All these different theories and speculations.
I think all those factors contribute. I don't think it would be fair to point to any one as, you know, the ultimate explanation. But certainly all those factors contribute. You know, we have had a lot of violent criminals in Baltimore. We have a lot of armed criminals in Baltimore. And for a long time, really a decade, we were succeeding in reducing that violent crime rate. Now we've seen it spike up again. But, you know, I'm optimistic. I think that we may see an improvement so far. August has been better than May, June, and July. And if we keep moving in that direction, I think we may get things back under control.
All those things that I just mentioned, other theories are scores being settled. People have the idea that maybe the police aren't as vigilant right now, so it's a good time to pay back somebody. All of those theories are in play.
I think they're all relevant. You know, you have to keep in mind that we have a proportionately relatively small number of people who are carrying guns. It's not just a few people. There are a fair number of folks out there, but proportionately it's a small number. And your law enforcement strategy has to be to deter them from carrying guns, essentially to scare them into leaving their guns at home. And I think the challenge the city is dealing with is, on the one hand, they're trying to improve community police relations, and that involves backing off a little bit in policing. But on the other hand, there are armed criminals who are going to take advantage of that, as you suggested, because they're dealing drugs, because they have scores they want to settle, you know, whatever it may be. They're more emboldened when there's less policing. And so I think they took advantage of that, the riots, the looting of the pharmacies, the police indictments. You know, that dynamic really changed things dramatically on the streets. And if you look at the impact in the immediate aftermath of the riots and the indictments, May was just a horrible month. We had 18 more murders than May in last year and 63 additional non-fatal shootings, which is an indication of a lot of criminals out there in the streets using their weapons. I think the commissioner has a good plan to clamp down on that, and you're seeing more aggressive policing. The tremendous drop-off in arrests has somewhat declined. We've got more arrests occurring now. And I think that all that indicates that things are moving in the right direction.
So if we look at the chart, just in the last month or so, we would see more arrests.
My understanding from the police department is that arrests are up. Now, again, you know, what's your baseline? I think you know, one thing not everybody recognizes is that they're over the 10-year period in which homicides declined from the neighborhood of 280 down to 200 or fewer, arrests actually dropped in Baltimore. And that's the product of a change in policing strategy that preceded the riots.
That
Fred Bielfeld had brought in and Tony Batts had continued of reducing the emphasis on zero tolerance and trying to target violent offenders. Of course, your objective is you're not going to catch the murderers committing murders. Your goal is to catch them committing drug crimes or carrying weapons, things you can prosecute them for that aren't going to require you to prove the murders. That requires proactive, aggressive policing, and I think the police are very much committed to that.
The U.S. Attorney's Office in Baltimore, the FBI, the DEA, have been involved in arresting, bringing to justice, getting convictions of BGF members, gang members in Baltimore. It seems like this violence goes beyond the realm of just gang activity, huh?
I think that's true. You know, as I said, there's no single explanation. A fair amount of it, I think, is gang-related, and we have a number of proactive investigations. We're looking at the areas that have the most violence and the organizations that we think may be responsible for that violence, and I think you'll see gang indictments, conspiracy indictments to follow in those cases. But also there are a fair number of, you know, one-off disputes. You know, when people, when dangerous criminals are carrying guns on the streets, occasionally things happen. And, you know, that's what we need to do. We need to get back to a situation where the criminals are afraid to carry guns on the streets.
You mentioned police community relations. Of course, that's been on everybody's mind. There's been heightened focus on that for the last year, especially. So I wonder about your role, what you see as your role in that in terms of police training. Let's just talk about that specifically. Did the previous commissioner, Anthony Batts, and the present commissioner, Kevin Davis, have they talked to you about using federal personnel for additional training of police officers?
Yes. You know, there are multiple roles the Justice Department has in this area. One is the U.S. Attorney's Office, which is a local outpost, essentially, of the Justice Department. But we also have Justice Department agencies in Washington that can provide help and are providing help. And so we've been working with the police department. We've had meetings with the commissioner and with a variety of DOJ agencies that are able to help, from the Civil Rights Division to the Community-Oriented Policing Services section. And the Bureau of Justice Assistance. There are many agencies in Washington that provide guidance and advice to police departments, and we're trying to coordinate that and make sure the department gets all the support that it needs, including training. And I think that's an important component of it, both training about police tactics and training about law.
So that actually may be the result of a Department of Justice investigation, right?
Well,
additional
training.
Maybe a recommendation that comes out of that?
It may be. You know, the Civil Rights Division investigation, which we're assisting with as well, which referred to as a pattern and practice investigation, that's not a short-term project. That's a long-term project. But in the meantime, all the federal agencies are working to deliver immediate assistance to the department, and the Civil Rights Division is assisting with that as well. But you know, the ongoing investigation is going to take a while and hopefully generate some recommendations if they do find a pattern in practice of misconduct down the road.
Just one last thing about this, Rod Rosenstein. The federal assistance in the war room that the city police are getting now, this is to help them catch up because of the volume of homicides and shootings, more so than to head off future violence. Theoretically, I guess if you arrest somebody for a homicide or shooting that occurred in May or June, you are, preventing additional shootings. But this is really to help the police catch up, right?
Right. I think, war room may not be the best term for it, but the objective is essentially sort of a situation room, a place where we gather all the intelligence. You can't necessarily separate those objectives of arresting the folks who committed the murders in July and preventing the murders in September. They're really related because typically you're talking about the same group of individuals. And so, as I said, one of the goals is to find effective ways to hold them accountable for what they're doing, not always by prosecuting for murder. Murder cases are very difficult to prove anywhere, particularly when they're drug-related crimes in Baltimore, because your witnesses are, number one, often criminals themselves. Number two, they're intimidated. They're afraid to cooperate. It's very difficult to prove those murder cases, but usually the people carrying the guns are involved in the drug trade, and so you may be able to prove a drug conspiracy case. You may catch them with a gun or with drugs and be able to prosecute for that. So there are other strategies that can be used to get these dangerous folks off the street.
Rod Rosenstein, U.S. Attorney for Maryland, is going to stay with us as we continue this hour of midday with the subject of human trafficking. We're going to get into that after this short break here. First break on our show, our noon hour. We'll be right back. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. Human trafficking, defined as modern-day slavery, I said at the outset of the show, it includes the prostitution of children and adults and often forced labor. The Maryland Human Trafficking Task Force has been working to identify and prevent human trafficking here alongside the FBI's Child Exploitation Task Force, which is a national group that has a Maryland branch. Investigators from the Maryland State Police and local law enforcement are in the field weekly, often each night, working to identify victims of human trafficking in the state who are working some of the metro area's upscale urban and suburban communities, the Inner Harbor, Hunt Valley, hotel rooms around the airport, BWI, and in Towson. They monitor daily advertisements for escorts and other personal services that could be involved in the trafficking world. Rod Rosenstein, the U.S. Attorney from Maryland, is back with us in the studio. We'll continue with us in this hour as we talk about this subject of human trafficking. Also joining us now, Amelia Rubenstein, a clinical social worker and researcher now at the University of Maryland School of Social Work's Child Sex Trafficking Victims Initiative. And I mention that because prior to this, you had been at Turnaround, right, in Towson, which focuses on domestic violence as well as human trafficking. So, Amelia, nice to have you back on the show with us.
Thank you for having me.
Amelia Rubenstein. And Corporal Chris Heed is with us from the Maryland State Police, the State Police's Child Recovery Unit. And I notice that you have been cited for your work in this field by the Justice Department. It's nice to have you on the show, Chris.
Thank you for having me.
Corporal Hyde. So this term, I'm going to go back to Rod on this one, Rod Rosenstein. So human trafficking has been a term, I don't know, it seems like we've heard a lot about it in the last 10 years or so, in the last decade. And I think we know what it means. I've sort of given a quick description of it there. It usually means forced prostitution, forced labor. What would you say?
That's exactly right. It's intended to sweep in all types of crimes in which people are forced or coerced to do things, whether it be work, effectively modern-day slavery, often involving people who are illegal immigrants who don't have access to the sort of resources that American citizens would have, and child sex trafficking, as well as prostitution with adults when it's accomplished through coercion or force.
Amelia, on prostitution, how do we determine if something is human trafficking or just prostitution?
So I think the federal law is pretty clear in that for people who are involved in prostitution through force, fraud, or coercion who are adults, then that's trafficking. But for children, so anyone under the age of 18, you don't have to prove that force, fraud, or coercion. So if you have a young person, age 16, involved in any type of commercial sex act, and that actually doesn't have to be prostitution. It could be stripping, pornography, any type of sex act that's exchanged for something of value, then that young person is automatically defined by federal law as a trafficking victim.
So the tougher one, when it comes to prostitution, Corporal Hyde, Chris Hyde, is determining whether someone is forced into it or not, right?
Correct.
So how do you determine that?
We have a variety of techniques that we use, but I mean, we treat every girl as when we walk in a door and we make a date, per se, we treat each girl as a victim. And when we walk out of that door, that girl's still a victim in our eyes. At one point in time, we feel that she was probably trafficked or someone turned her onto this. We don't think that any girl in the almost 5 years we've been doing this, that I've been doing this, I don't think I've seen one girl that said, like, I want to be doing this. We don't ever see that. So each girl to us is a victim. But we look for different signs that, you know, not to get into all that here, but there are signs that we see that we can tell. Usually in the first 5 minutes of a conversation, I can say this girl has a pimp or this girl does not have a pimp.
And, of course, in the case of a minor, you can tell right away, right?
Absolutely.
Whether it's a human trafficking case. So, Rod, I'll go back to you on this question then, because it seems to me over the years, Baltimore City Police, Baltimore County Police, local police departments have arrested people for being involved in prostitution, right? For the pimps as well as the prostitutes themselves. But we get to human trafficking, this term, because of the federal oversight, because it's the federal statutes?
Right. What motivated us primarily to initiate the federal task force, which has been around now for about 7 or 8 years, was specifically to focus on child prostitution. And the challenge, Dan, as you mentioned, is that when police make arrests for prostitution, they traditionally treat the prostitute as the criminal, not the victim. And so the innovation, really, that I think this task force has brought is what Corporal Hyde referred to, which is to treat the prostitute as a victim and a witness and try to prove a case against the pimp or the person who's actually masterminding the scheme. And so Chris made reference to setting up dates. That's a tactic, an undercover tactic, for example, where they'll find somebody whose sexual services are being advertised and set up a sting operation. But they go in there with the attitude not that they're going to arrest the prostitute, but that they're going to treat her as a victim. They're going to get her services that she needs through working with our community outreach organizations, and they're going to try to develop a case against these dangerous pimps who are getting kids into prostitution.
Speaking of kids, Amelia, how do kids get into this? Can you give us some idea about are they missing children? Are they children who've run away from home? Are they children from broken homes, from foster homes?
Yeah, very often they have a lot of family chaos or something dysfunctional going on there where a need is not being met, either a material need, so it could be poverty or their families become homeless or they have become homeless, either they've been kicked out or we see a lot of LGBTQ youth who are forced to be homeless because their families don't support them, youth in the foster care system, youth who have experienced abuse and neglect, and for some reason they've been come kind of disconnected from their family of origin. So very often they're runaways. And I think pimps are really good at targeting young people who have that kind of need, whether that's an emotional need or a material need, and honing in on it and kind of using that to manipulate or recruit someone into doing what they want.
Chris, why don't you tell us a little bit about your work? How do you go about this?
We started probably about 5 years ago. We're part of the Maryland State Police Child Recovery Unit, and our unit's been around for 10 to 11 years, and it was primarily for missing kids. Once we started realizing the human trafficking aspect, and it kind of integrated, they kind of rolled over into each other. So we're looking on these different websites, and primarily it's Backpage.com. Which is a legitimate website that advertises everything from furniture to escorts. But we'll look at that daily. We have partners in Baltimore County and all these different jurisdictions, and we've actually become friends with these guys, and we talk daily. Hey, I saw an ad here, I saw this, or that. We have allied law enforcement in Baltimore County, Anne Arundel County, all these other counties that for missing kids sections that'll call us and say, I have a girl that's run away four times. And to me, that's like a red flag. If I have a young female that's run away three or four times, she's in my eyes, she's more likely to be involved in or possibly be involved in some sort of
trafficking. So someone has reported her as a runaway?
Yes.
Three or four times? So a family member or a friend is concerned about the child.
Yes. I mean, that's not to say that we have recovered juveniles involved in this, that we run them through our local system and they're not listed as a missing person. So there are girls out there that mom and dad or for instance, live in Baltimore City, and we'll call them. Oh, I didn't know. I didn't even know. My daughter's supposed to be here. So it's not every time, but the majority of the time, probably 95% of the time, these girls are listed as missing persons, juveniles.
So you've actually had a small percentage of cases where teenage girls have run off to do this, take part in this, without their parents' knowledge.
Correct.
Right. Yep. Chris Hyde with the Maryland State Police, Amelia Rubenstein, now with the University of Maryland School of Social Work. So you're doing more research on this at the School of Social Work. What is your project?
So our project now is the Child Sex Trafficking Victims Initiative. So it's a federally funded 5-year project to help Maryland Department of Human Resources and their child welfare system address this, because we know that there's a huge overlap between the majority of children who are trafficked have had some sort of contact with the child welfare system. And so there's a big responsibility on the part of the child welfare system to come up with a comprehensive response. And that means training workers, policies, having placements and services in place for these kids. These are really, really high needs kids. They come with a lot of complex trauma, a lot of runaway behaviors. They are very resistant at first. Usually when Chris and I were working together on cases, when you show up, they're not glad to see you. They see you as kind of separated.
Have you worked with Chris?
Yeah, Chris and I have worked on a lot of cases together.
So they're not glad to see you. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, not glad to see you. They kind of see you as the enemy. They see you as they're fearful. Their pimp has probably told them that they're going to be arrested. Their pimp has told them that they're going to be sent to the worst group home they've ever heard about. And so they have a lot of kind of fears and misconceptions about what's going to happen next. And I think that the approach that Chris and the rest of the task force take in terms of really treating them as victims and taking the time to get to know them, build a relationship, is so important for making these cases.
In the case where minors are involved, Chris and Rod, that leads to potentially other charges, right? Not just for the pimp, but for people who engaged in sex with minors, right?
Correct. Yes.
You've had cases like that?
Yes, we've had cases where that. In a lot of the cases, they're harder to prove, because to try and find those individuals, if we can track them down. Sometimes all we have is a cell phone number. We may have like a throwaway phone. But yes, we have had cases where
focus is the victim, right?
Yes, absolutely.
The child. Rod, what about that on the federal side? Mm-hmm. You have cases like that?
Yeah, typically on the federal side, we're not prosecuting the customers. We're prosecuting the pimps. But mm-hmm. we do face that challenge, as you mentioned, that getting the victim the services she needs and gaining her cooperation and trust so that she'll be available to testify at the trial, that occupies a lot of our time.
Boy, that must be tough.
It's really
hard. What do you say to young women involved in that?
I mean, I think we kind of start – they don't see themselves as victims very often, I think. And so we kind of start from a place – if the young person is saying, my boyfriend, which is very often how they see that person, and I say, your pimp – then we've obviously kind of shut down that conversation. So I usually try to kind of not be an enemy towards that person and really just figure out, what does she need? What does she want to know right now? She usually wants to know, when am I going to eat? I haven't slept in a while. I need to change my clothes, that kind of thing, and figure out how to meet those basic needs. And that's where we really start to build trust. And I try to be as transparent with them as possible. If I don't know something, then I tell them I don't know. And then give them as much information and options as possible.
I was just reading an essay recently by a criminologist who said a lot of the phone calls that come in to police for help, 9/11 calls, should be handled by social workers. that there are calls where, a police officer may not be needed so much as a social worker. So it seems like this is and that takes us into that realm. So, Chris Hyde, when you go out to visit, say, a hotel someplace where you suspect something's going on, and you meet a teenage girl, you can tell right away, she's a teenager, this is a human trafficking case. Is Amelia with you, or are other social workers with you, or is this something you've been trained to do?
We get them involved. I mean, we do take training ourselves, but the majority we have is, it's a very complex investigation. I mean, these are really difficult investigations to complete because you have this victim who does not believe she's a victim at that point. And then that victim thinks that she's getting arrested. So you have to break down this huge wall that you have in front of you. So we do. We'll call in Amelia, or we have victim witness people with the FBI that we work with on our task force, and they are phenomenal people. We bring them in kind of we try to build a rapport at the beginning, and then we bring this other individual in saying, this person is not a police officer. And that person will kind of sit with that with the juvenile and work everything out. And they have to contact CPS, and all these other places that we're focused on. We're making an arrest of a pimp. We have to deal with that guy at this point.
Right.
But we build this rapport with these girls. We have a girl down in out of state right now, 15 years old. We still go out and we talk to these girls, and we'll go down and have lunch with them and just say, hey, we're here. We're still a part of your life. Because a lot of times these girls, they have no constant in their life.
In that case, you mean she moved out of state?
She was placed. So
she was placed in foster care.
Yeah. And this is a case that we didn't even arrest the pimp. We just recovered this girl on the street doing this. But she had no family. She still has no family. So we try to build these rapports, and it's hard, but the word gets out. We'll go out on a date, for instance, and we might meet a 20-year-old girl, and I say, have we met you before? She's like, no. And I'll say my name or my partner Debbie's name, and she's like, oh, I've heard about you guys. Or the guy Dave from Baltimore County, I've heard about you guys. The word's getting out. And then also we're getting the word out with these pimps. We had an individual the other day. We know he's a pimp, and we're still working a case, trying to build a case. But the word out of his mouth was, I brought up this, the girl he had with him was 19 years old. And I said, what about, when did you start working with her? He said, oh, no, when she was 18. He said, I don't mess with no kids. That's 10 years. So that word's getting out. The federal law is a minimum of 10 years. And so to me, that was like a win for us. I was like, that's awesome. We got this guy that, he is doing what he's doing. It's wrong. But our word is getting out that we're not messing around. When you pimp a kid out, you're going to jail.
Yes, and the federal penalties are quite heavy, up to life in prison, right, for sex trafficking
that's
under
right.
the federal law. I wanted to talk. I thought it would be helpful for our listeners to hear about a couple of cases that the U.S. Attorney's Office brought, Rod Rosenstein. So can we do that now?
Sure.
One case that I have here is from July. It's a federal indictment of Stephen Boyd, also known as Gotti, age 36, for sex trafficking. I thought this was interesting. Going to just to talk about the details of the case, how this was put together. He was a pimp who caused girls and women to engage in commercial sex acts going back to July 2013. The indictment alleges that Boyd, I'm just reading the press release that went with the indictment. The indictment alleges that Boyd recruited girls and women whom he met at hotels and other public places and online to work for him as prostitutes, including two girls who he knew to be under 18 years of age. I'm just noting here, he faces a mandatory minimum sentence of 10 years and up to life in prison for each of two counts of sex trafficking of a minor, a mandatory minimum of 15 years and up to 30 years in prison for sexual exploitation of a minor, and more penalties after that for the additional counts. He actually persuaded some of these women to travel from Ohio and California to work for him here in Maryland. So it sounds like recruiting online, recruiting women from out of state to work for him.
Yeah, those are the allegations. Of course, this particular case is still pending, so the defendant's presumed innocent. But that, pattern that you described is typical of what we see in these cases. If somebody, as Chris mentioned, who's particularly good at persuading teenagers, frequently teenagers who are on their own, to engage in prostitution. Now, what he faces in this case, as you mentioned, it's a crime to engage in interstate prostitution, but it carries a mandatory minimum of 10 years to engage a juvenile, somebody under 18, in prostitution. So that, as Chris pointed out, that's the big hammer that we have in these cases, that if there's a prostitute who's under the age of 18, that defendant's going to face at least 10 years in federal prison.
Did you have another case that you wanted to talk about?
Well, we've actually had a whole series of them.
I've noticed that. The U.S. attorneys, I don't know if our listeners appreciate how busy your office is with criminal cases, and these are some of them.
Right. Well, I'll give you one example of a defendant who's already been sentenced. Thomas Tinsley was sentenced to 11 years in prison for sex trafficking of a minor. I think that's a case that Chris and Amelia are also familiar with. That particular defendant admitted that in May of 2013, he met a 15-year-old runaway in downtown Baltimore, invited her to live at his home, which was a motel in Baltimore. He then began having sex with the victim and then started prostituting her out to other clients, a 15-year-old child. You know, that's a classic situation that Chris deals with on the street, where you find a young girl like that who's out on her own, who trusted this fellow, who views him as a boyfriend and a protector and doesn't otherwise have a support structure. So when we make an arrest in that sort of a case, we need to bring in Amelia or other experts who are going to work with that child, find a way, you know, not only to get her life back on track, but also to gain her cooperation so she'll be available to testify at trial.
Wow. How do you do that, Amelia? Move in here and tell me about this. What's the number one obstacle you're dealing with there? Is it that the trust has developed between the minor and the prostitute? Is that it? I mean, as Rod says, they sees them as a boyfriend.
Yeah, I mean, that victim really, that person was her boyfriend, her world. I mean, he had said things to her and kind of given love and affection that she had not received at all at other points in her life. And we know for teenagers that is so, so powerful. It's powerful for us as adults, but for teenagers, it's really powerful. And he had also gotten her to a place, I think, where she felt like she had no other options, a place where was she going to go? Things were not really good at home. And so I think the number one obstacle is kind of helping them see that there are going to be other options, but it's also going to take a lot of time. I mean, you're dealing with a group that kind of clinically is difficult anyway when you're talking about 14 to 17-year-old girls.
Right.
And so then you have these kids who have experienced a lot of trauma, and you really have to – we don't have a lot of placements for these kids. We don't have great situations for them to live in sometimes that are specialized for their needs, because you have kids who have had a lot of sexual trauma. I mean, some of these girls have been forced to have sex with 10, 20 strange men a day. I mean, that's sexual assault after sexual assault. And so you need really highly skilled clinicians to handle that group.
In the case of that young woman, what was her family background? What can you tell us about that?
She had not been in the foster care system, but she had had a lot of running away, a lot of, I think there was a lot of conflict with her mom, and then a lot of substance abuse, I think, on her end and probably somewhere else in the family. So
we're going to take a break here. We'll come back and talk some more. Before we do, let's take this call from Sarah, who called in with a question about human trafficking here on Midday. Again, I didn't give this earlier, our phone number, if you have questions for our guests, 410-662-8780. You can also write an email question and send it to email midday@wypr.org. Sarah, go right ahead with your question. Hello.
Hi. Yes. I am I'm much more concerned about sex trafficking among runaway teens and young people, but I'm also concerned about what I've seen an uptick in the last, say, 5 or 6 years, is the folks who are begging at intersections. And I was wondering if your guests knew anything about whether or not some of them, if that's like a slavery ring or some of the people involved in that might be trafficked.
A question about panhandlers that we see sometimes on median strips around the metro area.
I don't have an exact answer about the panhandling, but it does lead me to another kind of related thing, which is these magazine sale crews, if people have heard about these, where there have been cases of sometimes similar populations, especially homeless youth, who are recruited into magazine sale crews, or they sell different cleaning products.
And they go door to door.
And some of those have been trafficking cases because the people are physically punished if they don't make enough money or if they want to leave. Or there sometimes we had a case with a 19-year-old who was abandoned in Baltimore, in West Baltimore. She was from Tucson, Arizona, and she had been recruited by one of these magazine sale crews. The last report I was reading that said that people who do more begging or kind of selling of candy, that usually isn't a trafficking situation. Is not. But with a magazine sale crews, it definitely can be.
I was going to say, how do you know? How would you know if someone knocks on your door and said they're there to sell you magazines, which has happened to me?
Mm-hmm. I don't think you would.
You wouldn't be able to tell.
Mm-mm.
In that case, was the person, this was a minor, mm-hmm. a teenager?
No, a 19-year-old.
A 19-year-old, you said that. Recruited in Arizona to come to Maryland to sell magazines?
They had traveled all over the country, but yeah, she had originally met them in Tucson, and she had become homeless there with a one-year-old and had been recruited.
We're going to talk a little bit more about that, too, that aspect of it, of human trafficking, forced labor. We'll take a break here on Midday. We'll come back and talk some more with our guests. 410-662-8780 is our number. Welcome back to Midday. Amelia Rubinstein, clinical social worker and now researcher at the University of Maryland School of Social Work's Child Sex Trafficking Victims Initiative. We're talking about human trafficking in this hour of the show. Rod Rosenstein, the U.S. Attorney from Maryland, is in the studio with us, along with Maryland State Police Corporal Chris Hyde, who works in the State Police's Child Recovery Unit. So how many years ago were you assigned to missing kids, Chris?
Beginning of 2011 is when I started.
What did you think of that assignment?
It was great. It's a great job.
Is this something you asked for or something you were assigned?
The sergeant that was in charge of the unit at the time had actually brought it up to me. I was doing warrants at the time, and I explained to him my frustration with the fact that you know, we had so many warrants, but I wanted to spend time on like one particular warrant. I said I'd rather spend, you know, a week looking for this guy that, you know, did a first degree assault rather than just trying to close out a bunch of warrants, you know, because the warrant backlog, you had to get those down. And he said, I'm looking for somebody like that for my unit that'll spend a week or two looking for kids. So I was like, yeah, I'm in. A couple years later,
An eye-opener for you, how many missing kids there are?
It is, yes. And there's so many more that aren't reported that, you know, that unfortunately.
So from there into human trafficking, was an easy step. It was frequently related.
Yes. Yeah, we started, it seemed that, I guess it was like mid-2011 was one of our first cases. It was a missing girl out of Fairfax County, Virginia. And she had ties to Maryland. She had previously lived in the state of Maryland. I received a poster. We have people at our office that work with the Maryland Center for Missing and Unidentified Persons. They put out posters every day, and I saw a poster, and it said that she had ties to Maryland, and I just started looking at these different things, going through her social media sites and things like that, and I found a phone number that she was using, came back to a prostitution ad. That was our first case. We got the FBI involved. We were, you know, just starting with the task force at that point. Assembled a crew, went down and recovered her down in College Park and arrested a pimp.
Don't the pimps know that you're checking out Craigslist and Backpage.com?
They do, but they try to stay isolated for the most part. They're usually not in the room with them. I mean, on occasions we've had them there, but we've developed tactics now that to kind of counteract them. We know what they're doing. We know they're trying to watch us. We've even had pimps that say, "I know what you drive." They've said to me, "I know what the kind of car you drive." So we try to mix things up. I mean, they're not dumb by any stretch of the imagination.
How much of human trafficking for sex is associated with immigrants, or is that when we talk about human trafficking, is that mostly where we see forced labor versus for sex? Could you say that?
We have had illegal immigrants involved in sex trafficking cases. In fact, we had a major case out of Anne Arundel a couple of years ago involving prostitutes who were trafficked down from New York, would be brought down in vans, you know, for the weekend and then taken back. That's sort of a classic example where you've got somebody who is, because they don't have a lawful right to be in the United States. They're very reluctant to cooperate with law enforcement. They're afraid to run away. And so, you know, that's your sort of extreme case of somebody who is fully coerced and has no other options but to participate in the prostitution.
I think we actually have some good numbers that just came out from the Victim Services Committee of the task force. And so they looked at the different service providers and found in 2014, 381 sex trafficking survivors.
Say that again, Amelia. Sorry.
So 381 sex trafficking survivors were served in Maryland last year, and 373 of those were U.S. citizens. So only 8 were foreign nationals. I don't think that's reflective of what's actually happening. I think undocumented immigrants are way less likely to come forward, to call the police, to access help for a variety of reasons. But we definitely do see cases with undocumented immigrants, especially females, where there's both types of trafficking going on, or maybe there's labor trafficking going on, but she's also experiencing sexual violence in that home as a domestic worker or whatever it is.
Do we see labor trafficking in the Baltimore area much? Have we had many cases like that?
We have not had many recently, but I have no doubt that it's occurring, and there are investigations underway. The Department of Homeland Security has primary responsibility for those sort of cases.
That's a tougher one to track. It doesn't get reported very much. It's all very much inside baseball. The victim is concerned about, you know, their status in the U.S., or, right, as you said.
Yeah, I think that's true. The cases typically will come to our attention when somebody's injured, or when there's a law enforcement sting that brings it to our attention.
410-662-8780. Let's take a couple of calls for our guests. Kevin in Baltimore, welcome to the Midday Show.
Hi, good day. How are you?
Okay. What did you want to say, Kevin?
I have a question. I have a friend who he does that kind of stuff, and I was persuading him to, like, get out of that business, and he told me straight up, he said, look, he was introduced into the business by his father. He said it is so hard. He said he have a lot of money, but he don't know how to quit. He said he don't know where he could go to, who he could turn to if he turned to law enforcement or anybody, if they're going to arrest him. But he said he just needs help because he just want to quit. And that was straight up. He said he really wanted to do that. And I've been writing a movie script for the last 2 years about Baltimore and everything that's going on. And about 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago, I went just to see how the whole operation, how it goes down, so I could put it in the script. And I saw it, and I was like, it was that easy? He was like, yeah, it's that easy. He said, we know where the police at. We know when they're coming. We don't stay in the room with the girls, just like they were saying. But he said he needs some help to get out of there.
So, you, excuse me, Kevin, let me ask you a couple of questions. How old is your friend?
He is 20, I think like 25, 26, or whatever.
All right. And he's a pimp?
He's a pimp.
And you've seen him operate.
I saw him operate.
And you said to him, why don't you get out of this? And he says, I can't. The money's too good, basically. Is that what he said?
No, he said he's addicted to it. He said because he was introduced by his father. His father died. He said he was introduced by his father. He said he tried to stop, but it just keeps coming back, and he don't know where to turn to. He said it's just like a crack addict. They smoke, and they get high, and they need help.
I do actually think,
Kevin, stay on the line. Go ahead, Amelia.
I do actually think that there is a pattern sometimes of kind of pimping being passed from one generation to another. I remember a federal case that we had in 2012 in Baltimore that there was a bunch of children recovered as part of that case, and the 13-year-old boy was absolutely being groomed by his father, who was the lead pimp in this case, to start to pimp women. And I think there's a lot about it that has to do with money, but there's also a lot about it that has to do with power and control, the exact same way that a domestic violence perpetrator would kind of need a lot of assistance and a lot of therapy and a lot of work to kind of get out of that pattern. And especially if you have people, and we see this both probably on the, I'm not as familiar with the pimp side, but also with the women who have criminal charges and that criminal background, it is sometimes hard to move into a different position. So I would say that for help, I would look into abuser intervention programs that might have some kind of overlap.
Abuser intervention program? I mean, tell Kevin, what would you say to Kevin If your friend actually did want to make a change in his life, if you wanted to get him some help, so you would say?
I would contact local abuser intervention programs that are part of domestic violence centers. Like, I mean, that would be my only thought.
You mean like Turnaround in Towson?
Yeah. I'm not sure that they would absolutely be able to help, but that's the closest thing I can think of. I don't know of it. There's John Schools. There's abuser intervention. I don't know that we have anything for people who are traffickers.
So, Dan, I have a suggestion for Kevin. I mean, you describe this fellow as your friend. I think you ought to do the right thing. Tell him to stop. And if he doesn't, you need to do the right thing and call the authorities and report him. You can do that anonymously. You don't need to give your name. But, if somebody's trafficking children or abusing prostitutes and you think that's the wrong thing, you ought to report it.
Okay, Kevin?
Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Ed in Columbia had a question. Ed, you're on Midday. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I was just wondering while I was listening to the show that if there's any safe houses in the area for these victims. I'm in real estate, and I come across properties every now and again, and didn't know how I could get involved.
Oh, you mean your properties that you could use for a safe house, you mean?
Yes.
Okay, that's an interesting idea, Chris.
If you could leave your name and phone number with the radio station, I'd be more than happy to take that and pass that along. There are some scattered throughout the state of Maryland, but there's not enough, and we can definitely always use more of that. I don't know the logistics of how that would even work, but I would definitely be interested in getting your information and seeing how far we can go with that.
Ed, thank you for calling in, Ed, and stay on the line. Speak to our producer, Melody Simmons. Thank you very much for calling. A couple of emails here. One goes back to, Amelia, the story you were telling about magazine sales. Michelle has a question. If you suspect forced labor from someone knocking on your door, what should you do? Do you ask them if they are being forced to do this? Do you call the police? What do you do?
I mean, I would say calling the police would probably be an option. You could run that by them. You could also call the National Human Trafficking Resource Center, which runs a 24-hour hotline. I'll maybe let Chris talk about how the police would want to be.
I would say if you are concerned, and even not so much as sex trafficking, but any forced labor trafficking, if you just call the police. I mean, that's our job. When I was on the road, when I worked, for 15 years on the road, we handled calls like that all the time.
You mean people suspected someone was being forced to work?
Yeah, or they're just saying this person's in my neighborhood. They don't look, because they could be case in a house or anything like that. And I'm sure there's legitimate businesses as well, but if there's ever any doubt, just call the police. That's our job. Our job is to respond to your call and to go out and for us to find out what's going on.
And I also think you can, if you feel like there's an opening for you to say to that person who's at your door, are you doing okay? It doesn't have to be an accusation. It just kind of opening that up a little bit. Sometimes people will walk through that door and really actually will tell you what's going on, and sometimes they won't. You don't want to pursue it so much that you put that person in danger, especially when we see sex trafficking victims. I mean, if there's outreach workers and they pursue girls too hard, those girls are going to get punished by their traffickers later on. So you really don't want to put them in a dangerous position.
This email from someone who asked that I not use their name wonders about male prostitution. I live in an area of the city that is known for male prostitution. Most of the male prostitutes that I see on the street look very young to me. No one seems to take this issue seriously, even though it directly impacts our quality of life. The prostitutes and their customers use little hideaways in alleys and people's unfenced yards. Are your guests working on male as well as female prostitution?
Yes. Yes, we are. We are working on male. Now, the majority of the cases that we handle are female, but we do get a lot of. We just got a male recently, 17 years old, 3 weeks ago down in Columbia, Maryland, and he was working out of his own house with his mom when his mom wasn't home. But it does happen, and there are. My suggestion would be, again, call the police.
What did you do in that case?
We spoke to him at length, and we determined that this was just something that he did. I was the only phone call he got. I shouldn't say I. We had a female that called him, but he was a male posting on the female section, escort section. He got no phone calls. He wasn't even posted in the right section. But we had a female officer that made a date with him, went out, introduced ourselves to him. We scared the heck out of him, and then we sat down and spoke to him and his mom. And we've checked on him. He's doing good. He's in school. He made a mistake, but it does happen. We get tips. Again, Backpage sends us tips. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children will send us tips on males. So we are following up on those as well.
Chris Hyde is Maryland State Police Corporal assigned to the Child Recovery Unit. Thank you very much for being here today, Chris. And Amelia Rubenstein, who's at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. You both work on the state task force on this,
correct?
Right?
Yes.
And Rod Rosenstein, thank you for being here today. You have an assistant U.S. attorney assigned just to these cases?
Yes, we do. We have a coordinator who handles human trafficking cases.
Thanks for being here, Rod.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's our first day, first hour of Midday. We have another hour coming up. We'll take a break here for the news from NPR. Also take a break for lunch. Tuesday brought to us by Bagby Pizza Company, located in the historic Bagby Building near Harbor East. The Bagby Pizza Company offers brick oven, thin crust pizza sandwiches, pastas, and salads made fresh daily with delivery daily at nightly 5 to 9 p.m. and daily 11 a.m. to 9 p.m.